Okay, lecture number 9. Last time we were together, we were talking about the Fourier transformation, and we had talked about finitely many variables. And define the Fourier transformation and its partner, which for sufficiently smooth functions were pointwise defined. We talked about the limit n to infinity. In which case this would depend on an infinite number of variables. This becomes n goes to infinity, so that's an unfriendly constant. We'll give it another name so we're not so frightened of it. PLXL, then u of x, and we give that a nice name. And we said that these expressions should not be taken on face value as integrals, but they should be interpreted properly as linear functionals. And we invented such a notation. We said that u tilde p should be interpreted as the image of function x. There's a linear functional depending on the sequence p, and over here u of x sequence, something we could call inverse u tilde of its argument. Okay, today we want to substitute this expression for u tilde p into this integral. And that will give us an identity, which you well know. So that will tell us that u of x is equal to 1 over 2 pi to power n e to the I pl xl minus yl summation 1 to n u of y dn y. And the reason this is true is because this integral, there should be a dnp as well, this integral over p creates an n-dimensional delta function so that for smooth u, the evaluation with that delta function gives us the left-hand side as we expect. We want to generalize this expression as well to infinite dimensions. So that means I'm going to substitute u tilde of p in here when it has infinitely many variables. And that will give us an expression u of x is m prime squared, which I will call m. M is the product of infinitely many 2 pi's, just as it was before. This thing will come up often later, and we'll frequently use m as the notation for 1 over 2 pi to a large power. And then we had e to the I summation 1 to infinity pl xl minus yl u of y dx, dy dp. And this integral over p will give us the analog of a delta function now for infinitely many variables. That's called a delta functional, very frequently written with a different notation than the parentheses. So this is our delta functional again, just as the integrals here were. I use the word integral, but I use it loosely. These are to be interpreted as linear functionals. Ah, I promised you an example of this kind of idea where ingredients are separately not well defined, such as these three are not well defined. But if you keep them together and use that as a label for your linear functional, then I don't see anything seriously wrong with it. So here's my analog of this. You remember that when we had functions, say, of time, and I take a derivative of that by adding, so here's an analog, f of t divided by h, take the limit as h goes to 0, nobody argues with that. As a definition, this was introduced, the ideas were introduced historically, as we know, by Leibniz and Newton. Newton introduced the notation of the prime, and Mr. Leibniz introduced the notation df by dt. Now, in truth, this is an abuse of notation, a very good one, because it is not a quotient. If you regard it as a true quotient, and you evaluate the numerator and the denominator, it would be 0 over 0. And so it is improper to break this into its separate parts. And when I multiply this by dt and integrate, and as I have done, as I do in my calculus class teaching, and I probably have already done in this class, I say, let's just cancel those and write it as df. That's not leading to the wrong answer, except now that we're advanced, we know there are functions which are not the integral of their derivative. Those terrible, silly functions. But physics functions typically are. The answer is correct, but the mathematics of simply canceling that is, although terribly suggestive, the mathematics is not right. That's why I like Leibniz notation, because it is suggesting to do the right thing. Make it do the natural thing, and it gives you the right answer. But it is not 0 over 0. You do not separate that quotient and say, oh yeah, there's a df, and then there's a yesterday that's something in between. And then I write, oh yeah, by the way, there's a dt over that. You do not do that and say that these things are now part of a derivative, because that would be 0 times blah times 1 over 0. So that goes as a unit. And that's how I want you to interpret these things. This is not to be separated from that. It's not to be separated from that. And if you do that consistently, then you have much less chance of making mistakes. Okay, so that's the delta functional. That will be an important thing to use as we press forward. I want to talk about change of variables now. It should be 4.3, change of variables. Do it in an active way. There are two ways to make a change of variables, passively and actively. And if I have a measure, my favorite kind of measure I'm giving you as an example to use, the simple normal distribution, e to the minus b x squared over 2 times dx as d mu sub b, of x, one variable, one degree of freedom, then I could say I let y equal b prime over b times square root, times x. That's a change of variables. I guess I got it the wrong way around. Let me try it better. X is equal to b prime over b times y. So erase that one. Make that change of variables. Okay, well, let's do it once. That becomes e to the minus b prime y squared over 2 dy. Of course, there's going to be a Jacobian coming from this, and that meant my original formula was incomplete. I wanted to have this normalized, so I will have a square root of b over 2 pi, and now I will have a square root of b prime over 2 pi for d mu b prime of x. This change of variables, however, is not a very active way to look at the situation. I'd rather do the following. It may sound the same to you, but I claim it is not. I'm going to let x itself become x multiplied by this. I am changing the x-axis. So I will call this an active change of variables. And this one a passive change. What I want to do is express both the original and the final measure in terms of the same set of coordinates x. So under this situation, d mu b, d mu sub b of x, square root b over 2 pi, e to the minus b x squared over 2 dx, becomes square root b prime over 2 pi, e to the minus b prime x squared over 2 dx. And that can be my alternative measure.
So this equation, b prime of y, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you. So this one should be, the second line here should be argument y. Thank you. Okay. The point of this being that I can directly compare these two guys together. I want to say one is related to the other by means of a coefficient in front. And we've given names to these things before. This will be when the measures are equivalent to each other. And we'll see what that xc is. It's very simple to figure out. I simply want to remove the bx squared and replace it with a b prime. That's that, we'll do that. And to remove the b in front and replace it with a b prime. So that is the factor, c of x, which is the weight function which creates this change of measure. This thing is well defined for all x on the real line. Don't forget that x on the real line excludes plus and minus infinity. They are not part of the real numbers. So even though this thing grows, if b prime is less than b, if it grows as x gets large, it's still well defined for all x. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward for you to do. Let's take another example. So that's example one. Example two would be to take a rectangular support, which I will let be B high, and it runs between 1/2, 1 over 2B, and minus 1 over 2B. So again, it has unit area. So we'll call that d mu of x equal to rho of x dx, where this is my rho of x. I want to again change variables. X goes to x. This time I don't need the square root. So I will see if I got the right sign. I'm going to make this transformation here. So then I go to dmu prime. See, that one has a B dependence. This one has a B prime dependence. To rho prime of x dx. And rho prime of x is equal to the following function. It should be B prime high. And by this same transformation, it gets to be in the interval 1 over plus to minus 1 over 2 B prime. Now I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, forget the ladies, for which relationship B prime bigger than B or B prime less than B, is this a legitimate connection of the two measures? Anybody want to guess? I claim it has to be that the new measure sits inside the old one. And therefore is taller. So this is okay, this is out. Because this one, to say this, means I'm stretching out the support of the new measure, and I don't know what is out there. I have no knowledge of what this function should be. You say, well, that looks so obvious, I just do that. But that is a passive change of variables. When you claim that you can do that, you're just relabeling the old point. This point has become this point in the new. I'm not doing that. I'm taking the same old x's and I'm making this transformation. Anyway, I'm in charge. I make that claim. So that means that the measure B prime here on this one is absolutely continuous. That was the correct term for the situation with respect to the previous measure. And example 3 is pretty straightforward. I just take two delta functions, or I start with a delta function like that, x at the point 1 over b. So here is my measure. Now I'm going to make my standard transformation. X goes to b prime over b times x. Well, okay, I got to do a little work here. So I'm going to put this straight in. So that becomes b prime b x minus 1 over b. The dx of that gives me a dx here and a b prime over b in front. There's a common 1 over b in this side, the delta function. And you remember how delta functions work. Delta of ax is 1 over a delta of x when a is positive. So I'm going to bring that b outside. When it comes outside, it's going to come up upstairs and it's going to cancel that b. So I have a b prime delta of b prime x minus 1 dx. I want to bring this b prime inside. When it goes inside, it comes in the upside down way. So that's going to come inside. Cancel that b prime, give me an x, and put a b prime down here, dx. So that's my new measure under this transformation, like that. Okay, so that new measure sits over here. In this case, they are disjoint. Irregardless of that, I have no choice about it. Mu b prime is perpendicular to mu b for b prime unequal to b. Okay, so that's the three examples of a change of an active type change of variables. Before we get too far and apply this straight away to our infinitely many degrees of freedom, let's look at what happens for the characteristic function. In example 1, we have e to the minus t squared over 2b versus e to the minus t squared over 2b prime. That's the characteristic function for b and for b prime. And clearly, these guys are continuous in the parameter b. You say, why? Do I emphasize that? Is it obvious? Wait. Example 2. CB of T, what was our example 2? It is this little rectangular looking animal here. Fourier transform of that is the same as sine T over 2B divided by T over 2B. And if I change the B to something else, that is this. And the point being, again, that this is a change from here to here is nothing more than a continuous change of the parameter B. Again, continuous in parameter B. Now, before I make the punchline of all this, I want to put up number 3. CB, in this case, is e to the IT over B. And CB prime is e to the IT over B prime. Again, monotonous, continuous, and parameter B. Point B. Although the measure support properties in the three examples are fundamentally different from each other, that difference is not automatically apparent in the characteristic functions. Characteristic functions are smooth in that variable. Yes, they carry an imprint of the support. And I would have to take the Fourier transform to literally find the support. But over here, that's not visible. The support is not visible. And all of the three examples are continuous in B. So in the characteristic function world, in the world of characteristic functions, the support question is suppressed. It is not an important question to talk about.
So, for example, in the example 2,
yes?
If you just looking at the characteristic function, you will not be able to say that B prime has to be lesser than B.
That's correct. I would not see that. As far as the characteristic function goes, I could have either choice and they would move continuously one with another because the characteristic function has made an assumption about what is happening out here. It has said it is absolutely zero in every case. Similarly for a similar segment appears here. Okay, now let's go to our friend of infinitely many variables. We're not going to discuss all these cases. We'll concentrate on our regular choice, b over 2 pi to the n by 2, limit n to infinity, e to the minus b over 2, summation n equals 1 to capital N, x n squared, dn x. Characteristic function associated with this one for finitely many degrees of freedom is e to the minus 1 over 2b summation n equals 1 to capital N of tn squared. Take the limit of that, cb sequence becomes e to the minus 1 over 2b summation n equals 1 to infinity tn squared. Now we can ask ourselves, what would we think about a change of variables? Change of variables. Our first choice is we're going to let the same kind of thing we did before, x squirts out, x is multiplied by square root of b prime over b. What would this do for the support of the measures on the infinite dimensional cases? How do we relate these guys to one another when we have infinitely many degrees of freedom and we have two different b's? Well, we've already seen that those guys are perpendicular. Really? What was the point of that? The point was that we found that the support of this measure was on those sequences which had the following property. So with probability 1, the points in this measure, that underlies this in the infinite limit, lie on what we'll call this hypersphere. This is a sphere of infinite radius, okay, but it depends on B. Change B, you change that condition. None of the old points fit in. So that's why these guys are mutually singular with respect to each other. But you don't see that in their characteristic functions. They move smoothly back and forth as B changes to B prime. So that brings up an intermediate question. What kind of transformation can I make on the X's which will actually let the two measures be equivalent to each other? Transformation, so again, an active transformation such that mu nu is equivalent to mu old. That's a big question, a lot of transformations. I'm only interested in linear transformations. They're the ones I can calculate. I'm even going to specialize to transformations which depend in the same way that we had before. Uh-oh, that failed. So I got to do something a little more clever. I have to make it n dependent. So I'm going to make those things depend on n. You can see, then I can take the prime away because I don't need the prime to distinguish them at this point. You see, if b sub n was equal to b, if that was 1, there would be no difficulty in it. And indeed, for finitely many changes of those coordinates, I know that I will have equivalence of the measures. So the question is, how fast does bn have to approach b in order to preserve this equivalence? Okay, well, that's not so hard to do. We do it in the same way we've done before. Here are the two measures, the b. Yes, question.
In the case of infinitely many variables, do you know in advance that there exists a set of such b's, bn's, not all identically equal to b, that satisfy this question?
So the question for the tape recorder is, do we know there's any answer to that? And of course I say, yes, there is. You mean infinitely many?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to find the criteria. I know that finitely many...
This is in fact going to be an existence problem.
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. So, what do I have to do? I guess the prime is still around, so let's keep the prime. B prime n over b to the 1/2 product from n equals 1 to infinity. That would be the change of the numerical factor in front, fixing this little factor from b to b prime n. Upstairs, I would have to do, just like I did before, in the example, I would have a bn prime minus b xn squared from 1 to infinity. So that would be the presumed coefficient, like our xc of x, we called it a few minutes ago, in order to have this equivalence. Well, in order to have this equivalence hold, this has to be a well-defined function. In order for it to be a well-defined function, it has to hold for all x's. In particular, for x equals 0, that exposes this term. So this product, n equals 1 to infinity, bn prime over b to the 1 half must exist. And the second one is the exponent by itself has to exist. So all I need to do is make sure that the factor there will work. Okay. Now I'm going to show you one criterion will work for both of them. Well, we had a rule once on the convergence of infinite products. We said that A works if summation of the absolute values 1 minus bn over b square root converges. Bn prime. The b is fixed. Let's clear the b out of that. So that's the same as summation b minus bn prime to the 1 half converges. So that's what happens. The bn has to go to b at such a rate in order for this sum to converge, and then this first term will exist. And I mean it is specifically not allowed to be even 0. Okay, now, if this is true, that means every term has to be finite, clearly. In fact, they have to go to 0 in order for the sum to converge. So the supremum of this, indeed the maximum would be enough, maximum as well, is okay, of this will also be finite. Therefore, Bn itself prime is bounded by some constant up above. Cannot go to infinity. Cannot become increasingly large. Okay, I can use that as follows to multiply this expression by b to the 1 half plus bn prime to the 1 half. Okay, so what would I say? I would say that b, yeah, that was good. Bn to the 1 half summation times b minus bn prime minus to the 1 half. Yeah, okay. That thing is less than 2c because of this term. Less times the sum here, which is already infinity, or less than infinity, sorry. And what is that product equal? That product equals summation b minus bn prime is less than infinity. So from this criterion, we have deduced that this is true. But this, then, is a sequence of our lambda n kind of variables, where the lambdas, oh my goodness, sum should be positive. These are positive variables, and they are the sum is finite. In which case, we know, for our measure, that the lambda n xn's is less than infinity with probability 1. Consequently, this term is well defined. So B is well defined. And that becomes the criterion. This becomes the criterion. We can either say it this way, or we can say it in a little more natural way. Here,
that the BNs have to approach B such that this works. As an example, the BN prime is going to equal B plus 1 over N squared, because that is a convergent sequence.
Okay, now that's just one example of a transformation type here. And that has been discussed extensively in the literature. What more general transformation can you make? We won't talk about those, but let's imagine that it's a transformation of the type Xn goes to matrix Tnm Xm. So what are the conditions on the matrix T in order for this to be true?
Orthogonal.
Question? No.
Orthogonal.
What?
Orthogonal.
A general orthogonal will not work. You would think so, but it wouldn't work. Okay.
So that's a discussion of change of variables. We are done with chapter 4. We are going to move on to chapter 5.
Really fun stuff.
For a change.
Dr. Kwan, before you go on,
yes?
Can I ask you,
yes?
So what is the point now of doing active transformations instead of passive transformations? Because it seems that all of this could have been done by doing passive transformations instead.
Well, I wanted to persuade you that the rectangle to rectangle worked in one direction and not the other. Now, in point of fact, I've kind of undercut my own argument when I talk about the characteristic functions, and it didn't matter whether the B prime was bigger than the B. So it's probably more sound than Fourier. Okay, we're going to talk about stochastic variables now. This is chapter 5, 5.1. It will be called general remarks. It's not on your syllabus. That's something new. This is a huge subject. Yes, sir.
So the criterion that was that the determinant's not equal to zero, that matrix.
That oh, this one?
Yeah.
Okay. The criterion,
we're going to discuss it in a moment,
is that this has to be unity plus delta, if you like to call it that, where delta is Hilbert Schmidt. You just learned that yesterday. So the trace of this thing has got to be finite.
That's why a general orthogonal won't work. Okay.
Now, this chapter 5, as I say, is a huge subject, stochastic variable theory. I can only give you a portion of the good things. We will talk about the Wiener process at great length, but other things I will talk about more as statements and facts rather than developing them as much as one could like. Okay. We have had random variables before, and we had accountable or finitely many or countably many random variables. We're now interested in the concept of a random function. So we're going to let that be a function of time. Our index is going to be a parameter t, which is chosen to be time, and instead of the n. T can lie in an interval a to b, finite 0 to 1. It can lie in the interval 0 to infinity, or t can lie in the whole interval plus to minus infinity. We'll be talking about these two cases in particular. A random function of time is called a stochastic variable. It's not called a random variable any longer. It gets a new name, stochastic variable. And we'll qualify even that in a moment. It's conventional to describe them by correlation functions. So there is some process over which you're averaging, and that defines a function of L variables, T1, T2, TL, and the collection of these for all L determine the process. Now, I'd like to put quotations around the determine, but I'm a little nervous about it for you. You should know that a distribution determines the moments uniquely, but the moments need not uniquely determine the distribution. I don't know if you know that, but there are examples of giving you moments which can go to different, so this is M equals 1, 2, 3. We did different characteristics, different probability distributions, hence different characteristic functions. If there's an overwhelming need to appreciate this, I'll be happy to tell you. Otherwise, for cases of most interest, the moments determine the measure, hence the correlation functions also determine the distribution. But there are counterexamples.
So the correlation functions are like moments?
Sure. Absolutely right.
Do they necessarily all exist?
Well, yeah, I'm assuming they exist. They don't have to exist either. Right. So we'll assume they exist. And when necessary, we'll assume they're continuous functions. Not right now. Okay. If the CLTR point-wise defined, so that's a part of this existence question, that's called then X equals a stochastic variable. We're beginning to qualify it here. On the other hand, the C's could be distributions. So if the CL are distributional, like your friend the Delta function, then we call X of T is a generalized stochastic process. And we'll have an example of that later. We have our characteristics.
Is process and variable usable? In
one more time?
Is process and variable interchangeable use? Or
in my judgment, yes. Okay. We have a characteristic functional. And from the present perspective, all that is the average in the ensemble, the same arrow business, as this expression, where S will now be the name of our basic coefficients here. T will be our running variable, and T will run over our standard integration range here, unless specified. So that becomes our characteristic functional, depending on our function, S. And S can be taken as one of our test functions, one of our very smooth functions. Given enough properties of this. We saw last previous time about the Buckner-Minlow's theorem. We had certain properties. If S was zero, S should be one. If absolute magnitude should be one or less, positive definite property, that's self-evident from this definition, and finally continuity. So if we're continuous in this in a suitable space like we've talked about previously, then the Buckner-Minlow's theorem tells us this is the Fourier transform of some measure associated with that characteristic function. And we'll talk about that at some length with regard to our examples to come. Question?
What is the meaning of your first statement, if the moments are distributional?
If the moment distributions, the correlation functions are distributional.
With respect to the t's.
With respect to the t's. For example, C2 of T1, T2, we'll have an example where that's delta of T1 minus T2. That would be called white noise. Okay. Stationary distributions. This is applicable to the case, and only the case, where T is on the whole real line. Introduce the notation S tau, which is defined as follows. It's the original function S translated by the variable tau. And if the characteristic function S tau equals C of S for all tau in the real line, then our process is a stationary stochastic process. In particular, that would mean that the first moment should be independent of the point of time, therefore it has to be a constant. So C1 is simply a constant. X of T1, X of T2 is independent of the origin of time. Therefore, it can only be a function of the difference, variables, etc. Process called ergodic distribution provided C S tau plus U, so S and U are two test functions. S is the one that is shifted in time, the U is not. I take the limit as tau goes to plus or minus infinity, and that becomes the factorization of the two characteristic functions. In moments, that means, for example, that xt1 plus tau xt2 plus tau times x3 of t, x4 of t, t3, t4. No, no, that's the wrong question. The 3 is important. So here we go, x of t1 plus tau, x of t2 plus tau, x of t3, x of t4. Notice I've only shifted the time in two of these. And in the limit, as tau goes to plus minus infinity, that four-point moment factorizes into the product of two two-point functions. And so forth. If there were 12 of them here and 14 over here, then factorization would be the same. That's ergodic. Let me just put on one more, two more equations. We round out the day.
if I take x of t1 plus tau x of tl plus tau times x of tl plus 1 x of tm, let's say, and I take the connected moments, they were the ones up in the exponent, and I take the limit as tau goes to infinity, that is zero. Connected moments vanish in this situation, while the ordinary moments factorize.
Okay, we have pressure from the outside loving students who want to get more knowledge, so we'll call it a day. See you Monday.